Proverbs chapter 14, verse 17. Short-tempered people do foolish things, and schemers are hated. Chapter 14, verses 29 through 30. People with understanding control their anger. A hot temper shows great foolishness. A peaceful heart leads to a healthy body. Jealousy is like cancer in the bones. Chapter 15, verse 18. A hot-tempered person starts fights. A cool-tempered person stops them. Chapter 16, verse 32. Better to be patient than powerful. Better to have self-control than to conquer a city. Chapter 17, verses 27 through 28. A truly wise person uses few words. A person with understanding is even-tempered. Even fools are thought wise when they keep silent, with their mouths shut. They seem intelligent. Chapter 18, verse 19. An offended friend is harder to win back than a fortified city. Arguments separate friends like a gate locked with bars. Chapter 19, verse 11. Sensible people control their temper. They earn respect by overlooking wrongs. Chapter 20, verse 3. Avoiding a fight is a mark of honor. Only fools insist on quarreling. Chapter 22, verses 24 through 25. Don't befriend angry people or associate with hot-tempered people, or you will learn to be like them and endanger your soul. Chapter 23, verse 15. Patience can persuade a prince, and soft speech can break bones. Chapter 25, verse 28. A person without self-control is like a city with broken-down walls. Chapter 29, verse 11. Fools vent with their anger, but the wise quietly hold it back. Chapter 29, verse 20. There is more hope for a fool than for someone who speaks without thinking. This is God's word.
All right. Now may the words of my mouth and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. So Chelsea Clinton once said, "Patience may be a virtue, but impatience gets things done." And even Peter Habegger says amen, right? Sounds true, right? So I want you to consider a story of how Michaela and I once woke up on a Sunday morning. So we woke up on a Sunday morning to some banging around in our yard, and we looked outside, and there was a guy that seemed to be, it was kind of the way you might behave if you were in a mosh pit at a hardcore show. Just a lot of flailing, and we were like, whoa, what is going on here? And then I get Michaela's like, "Andy, he's jumping on the hood." And he's on the hood of our car, jumping up and down. Now, at the time, we had an 87 Volvo station wagon. Fortunately, because it could handle this jumping, I don't know if our cars today would have been as unscathed as the Volvo. And that's about when we called 911. And while we were on the phone, we heard a loud crash. And then he was by our window in the backyard. So now he's in the yard in the back. He encountered our goat at the time in our yard and yelled a very loud expletive. And we were like, okay, this is, he didn't expect the goat. And about then he was tackled, boom, onto the ground. And the officers had responded very quickly. And at about that point, we started to feel a little bad because he started to cry. And you realized he was on a trip and he was not aware of what was going on. But we didn't know that until about that moment. And the officers were very kind and they deduced that as well after the tackle and, you know, processed that with us. And he seemed very confused. And they took him somewhere to get some care. So I ask you, were the officers impatient? Nope. Roland says no. Yeah. Is patience the opposite of Chelsea Clinton's quote, getting things done? Is it the opposite? So when you think of the word patience, really quick, crowd participation moment, what is the opposite of patience? There's an easy word. I'll give you a free one. Thank you, Garrett. I assumed that would come quickly. Okay, let's find some more. Hasty, impulsive, short-tempered, brash.
What year was this?
I don't know if that, yeah. What year was that? It's been a little bit.
This might be different in 2026.
You never know. Never know. So, okay. Why do you like when a person is being patient?
Because I need it.
Because you need it. Daniel's smile. yeah, why else? Why do you, maybe you don't all appreciate it, but if you do, why do you appreciate it?
Get stuff done.
When they're patient, they get stuff done? Okay. What's that?
100% you get more stuff done when you're patient when you're not, as the father of a four-year-old.
Ooh. Yeah, as a father of a four-year-old, Garrett reports getting more done when patient than not. Shua, did you have something to add?
It makes it easier for me to do things that I want to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
God's mercy.
God's mercy. Shua is saying it makes more room for him to do things that he wants to do. Yeah. Sure.
Understanding.
It's people are more understanding. Yeah. Can de-escalate a situation. Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. We're, for those of you who've been around, you know this, but if you haven't, you don't. We are looking at wisdom literature for the year. It's a bit of a lost genre. It's meant to make you think. It's meant to be wrestled with. We've described it as a hard candy type of scripture, which means hard candy, if it's eaten quickly, can be one of two things. Either ineffective, if you just pop a hard candy in your mouth and swallow it. Okay, sure. But you don't really get the intended experience. If you pop a hard candy in your mouth and chew, it's also a different experience. You get a little flavor, but also you might hurt your tooth. Hard candy was designed to spend time on, to contemplate, to process. You need to treat it with patience. Yes. And today, as we look at this selection of Proverbs that are all around the theme of patience, we're going to just consider what it is, what it isn't, what it is, why to cultivate, and how to cultivate it. So this is a little more practical this week. What it isn't, what it is, how, why to cultivate it, how to cultivate it. So I'm going to march through. You heard a lot of Proverbs there, and we're going to go through a few of them to get some of our answers. So what it isn't, we read in 14:17, a short-tempered person will do foolish things and schemers are hated. A hot-tempered person starts fights. A cool-tempered person stops them. Sensible people control their temper. They earn respect by overlooking wrongs. So you all are You're better at this than me, honestly, because I was a little surprised at something when I dug into the idea of patience in the Proverbs. And some of these Proverbs in here wouldn't have been my first picks. But Proverbs tends to contrast patience mostly with hot-temperedness, or what you could call anger or unrestrained anger. And in my mind, I was thinking patience was more of an issue of being willing to wait, right? Like when we Christians talk patience, one of the things we tend to talk about is waiting on God. Like we are trying to be patient while God is doing whatever he's doing. And we tend to think it's taking forever, right? It feels almost like a test that we're being given. Like while God is up there and he could do it now, he's taking his time and he's judging us on how we do with that, right? It can feel a lot like treading water. growing up in Tucson, I did swim lessons. I'm sure that's not just a Tucson thing. How many of us did treading water and swim lessons? Got a few. Okay, you're going to survive out there now. You had to do this, right? And they at my swim school did a competition for treading water. And the idea is that, you know, the outside person, the teacher, is going to stand there. Sometimes they joined you, but they were better at it, as in our conversation about God's law, right? They were like real strong and just effortless. And, you know, it's hard to stay afloat, and you had to stay in the same place, and you're just there, you're just trying to stay afloat, you're just trying to stay in the same place. And if you're able to do it, kudos to you, you're a good swimmer. If you're not, sorry, you stink. You know, that kind of is how it felt. Like, good luck surviving in the ocean if you're shipwrecks. If you want to survive, get better at this. And that's kind of how it feels in regard to being a Christian. If you need to be patient when life stinks, and if you do, you're a good Christian. And if you don't, well, life's going to be hard for you out there, right? That's kind of how I was thinking about patience, if I'm totally honest. Culturally, I was thinking about this. I think this impacts those inside and outside of the Christian faith. It feels like a good way to be regulated. I Googled patience. I like to do these kind of things. And this was like the fourth picture that came up, and it was right on par with all the ones that filled my Google screen. What is patience? Boom. Meditation in the face of all the stuff that's supposed to be done. There were a lot of photos like this, and almost all the ones that came up on Google showed someone meditating, actually. And they showed various amounts of cultural pressures. So one of them actually just had like 50 different hands like presenting problems. And the person was in the meditation pose, just zenning it in the middle of all of that. So like being regulated. And to not commit the cultural sin of being annoying or overbearing or causing people trauma because of your stress. That's a sin in our culture. You're not supposed to, if you're stressed, you're not supposed to become annoying or overbearing or traumatic. You're supposed to stay chill to not mess up other people's lives. So you try to be patient. But it gets muddy when you come up against another one of our cultural virtues, which is authenticity. They call our time the age of authenticity, that you're supposed to be your truest self. So sometimes when people feel upset or critical or mad, it feels like you're supposed to express yourself, because unlike your repressed parents who we broke away from, and I know some of you are the age of repressed parents, and my repressed parent is on YouTube. I love you, Mom. She's actually not repressed. But some of those parents were trying, what they're doing with this as we're all being authentic is they're trying to be less annoyed with all of us authentic people. They're trying to tolerate our authenticity. So that's potentially going on in the room. But to not be authentic feels like a sin against God. And I mean that because by God, I mean the spirit that we worship in our time, which is me. It feels like a sin against me to not put me at the center of the universe and express myself. So being patient is confusing because it's like a damned if you do, damned if you don't scenario where you're either going to annoy people and potentially traumatize them, or you're going to sin against yourself and not express yourself. So what do you do, right? Those are the ways I was thinking about it. And I think those are even natural within me. I feel those within myself. But here in the Proverbs, patience is pitted up against the hot temper or the short temper, or literally the way it's phrased is speeding into anger. And the opposite of it, of impatience, is to be slow to anger. That's at the core of the meaning of patience, to be slow to anger. And I would add that I think when it's saying anger, it doesn't just mean rage. I think it'd be all the emotions that stem from our anger. So here's like an emotion wheel. There's a great pillow of this. If you can't figure out how you're feeling, you could buy the pillow. And, you know, when you're mad at your husband, you can be like, I am feeling that, you know. But anger is the big one. It's the red one. But the ones next to it are very related, like disgust. You might feel disgust because of some anger, fearful. There might be something that makes you to some degree upset and afraid at the same time. They're related emotions, which is why they're placed next to each other. So quick to those emotions. So when we're impatient with people, it can be because of our anger. And at who? Anger at people? Sure. But I think often the truth is it's anger with God. And the God of the Bible? Sure. But remember, in our culture, the God is here, is me or you. So anger maybe is anger at me taken out on you that's causing me to be so impatient. I'm sure you know this. I've said it. It's intuitive, but it's sometimes hard to grasp. When you find yourself really angry with somebody, usually they're doing what you don't like in yourself. Like, that's typically what's going on. Nothing annoys me like a person who talks and talks and talks. It's exhausting. Have you ever spent time with me? Yeah. I am the chief of the verbal processors. I can go on and on. The modern proverb, it takes one to know one. Right? It applies here. It applies to me. It's a real thing. When something in you bothers you, you tend to hate it in other people, and we are angry about things. Okay? So, now, patience is not cast as denial of our emotions. I want to make that clear. The opposite of a hot temper is not no temper. It's a cool temper, right? The opposite of being fast to anger is not no anger. It's slow to anger. And that's important. That's really important. So I want to look a little deeper at some of these specific proverbs to think this through. 14:17 again said, short-tempered people do foolish things, and schemers are hated. So I think short-tempered people do foolish things. I'm going to assume we're agreeing on that. I want to talk about the schemers for a second. Schemers. What's up with schemers? This is a parallelism and an interesting one. It's giving us kind of two sides of a coin here. Like, here's one way you can treat emotions. You can be short-tempered, get quick to anger. But the other side of the coin is the schemer. When you hear the word scheme, what do you think? What's going on when people scheme? They're devising wickedness. Okay. What else?
And it's a slow, methodical planning.
Slow, methodical planning. Yes.
That's
Machiavelli. Yeah. Thinking of Tupac albums all of a sudden, surprisingly. Scheme anymore. What about
manipulation?
Yeah. Here, it's actually saying the flip side, that there's two ways to fall off this balance beam. You can be quick to anger, or you can manipulate and utilize emotion to do damage. So that's possible. So it's not necessarily that the answer is just to slow down. It's about a right relationship with emotion. The schemer is manipulating. One commentator describes scheming in the Hebrew as the mastering of feelings with ulterior motives. Whoa, right? The mastering of feelings with ulterior motives. So patience, you could say, has less to do with the denial of emotion, but a right relationship to emotion and a wise and loving deployment of emotion. 15:18 said, a hot-tempered person starts fights, a cool-tempered person stops them. So I return to the officers in my yard. if well trained, and they were, the officers in my yard de-escalated. They responded fast, but they de-escalated by bringing confusion into order. And then they responded with compassion as they discerned what was going on. Now, what's key to that happening? How does that happen in a fast moment? What did the officers need? Discernment, understanding, experience, training. See, their previous patience and going through a process led them to be able to respond well in the moment, right? So the hot-tempered person just starts fights. A cool-tempered person stops them. And sometimes stopping them requires having done a lot of work. 1911 said, sensible people control their temper. They earn respect by overlooking wrongs. Now, overlook here is an interesting word. It is the same word as this event, to pass over. This requires a little Bible knowledge, and it's okay if you don't have it, but the Passover, did God ignore wrongdoing when his people were passed over and they weren't judged before they were delivered from Egypt, while Egypt was judged? Did God ignore wrongdoing? No. How do you know that? What's your sign? What's your signal?
They put the blood of the lamb on their doorposts.
Yeah,
followed the instructions God gave to be passed over.
God had given them instructions to be passed over. The blood of the lamb on their doorposts. This signals something like of a sacrifice, of an atonement over them. It's not that what they had done was ignored. It's that God was going to overlook what they'd done because he had made a way for them. He had covered them. God responds to wrongdoing with a powerful and redemptive action, which is one of the reasons these people were moved to trust God. So people earn respect by overlooking wrongs. That doesn't mean saying, like, I don't know if that was really wrong. I don't really care. I don't want to see. It's a deeper idea than that. Okay? So patience isn't just waiting. It's not just regulating. It involves far more. Let's talk a little bit more about what it is. You could say it's about showing restraint. You could say waiting with purpose, like those officers who need to train, who need to prepare. It's reflecting and responding out of the fear of the Lord, which is the foundation of wisdom. That goes back to our first week of the year. That's the foundational principle of all wisdom literature in the Bible, the fear of the Lord. So we're going to look at a few more of those proverbs that exhibit this. 14, 29, and 30. People with understanding control their anger. A hot temper shows great foolishness. A peaceful heart leads to a healthy body. Jealousy is like cancer to the bones. Notice again here, it's not the absence of anger or its related emotions, but it's the restraint of it, which can include resisting immediate venting or verbalizing in many cases, or anything that removes the inhibition of our emotions, such as, okay, think about this. If you run to a substance to deal with your emotions, whether it's a pill or a drink, or even if it's a video feed that puts you at ease, that is a form of impatience. Why do I say that? Because it is not engaging in the understanding or managing of the emotion. It's just putting it away. It's ignoring it. It's not great understanding. It's not control. As this proverb says, when emotion is unmanaged, it is often exhibited foolishly and in a way that does damage. It can do damage to other people, of course. Those who live with people whose emotions run the show are impacted by that experience. And it impacts their emotions too and creates a whole community effect. It's a dynamic many of us have experienced. The relational opposite of 14:30 that we just read is Proverbs 12:4. A little dicey, but I'm going to try going there. Sorry, ladies. A worthy wife, it says, is a crown for her husband, but a disgraceful woman is cancer in his bones. Okay, sorry. The roles can absolutely be reversed. believe me. But what this is saying is that your command of your emotions, how you present yourself, worthy, disgraceful, and this is an honor, shame, culture talking here. We'll talk about that in a second. But it doesn't just impact you, it impacts those you're in relationship with, is what it says. We are responsible for the impact we have on others. But in verse 30 of 14, it shows that jealousy, which is an emotion, which is when you're angry that you don't get what you want, or you're angry that somebody else gets what you want, right? Can have the same impact on you, not just in your head, but it says upon your body. It's assuming the integration of your body and spirit. And most of us today, that many of our bodily issues are the impact of our emotional well-being. I've experienced this during a time of deep stress. I experienced hair loss because how I was doing emotionally manifested in my body. Others might experience pain. Others might experience fatigue, right? So it affects other people and it affects you, not just mentally, but entirely. Verse 17:27 says, a truly wise person uses few words. A person with understanding is even tempered. This is one of the funnier proverbs in a way. Even fools are thought to be wise when they keep silent. With their mouths shut, they appear intelligent. Is that okay? Do we agree that a wise person uses full words? Or few words, sorry. I'm seeing some head nods. I ask because I want to believe it. But there's some studies, and I've seen this. The Babel hypothesis. It postulates, and they've studied this, I believe at Harvard and some other schools, that in our society, at least, people who talk confidently, especially men, are deferred to. They get to lead. The study goes a little deeper to ask if the people actually trust them leading, and the answer is not necessarily. But they'll let them because they verbalize and take control. I hate to bring this up, but we had table conversations on Sunday. It's possible that if you represented your table, I'm just saying, it's possible. Roland, no. Because people defer and give leadership to the one who talks more. And actually, in some of these articles, they actually tell you if you want to be a leader, verbalize. They're telling you, just go with it. This proverb says, the wise use few words and maintain restraint. So I was thinking, I was like, is this just pragmatically a problem or do we really believe this? And then I thought about the book of Job and I thought about times when we're overwhelmed and troubled. And I think that's when our honest opinion comes out. You know, in Job, the book of Job is our oldest book of the Bible. So this, God's people had this before they had Genesis. And in it, God is in control of a situation in which a human being, Job, suffers at the hand of his spiritual enemy, and he suffers all kinds of natural things. And there's kind of a trajectory in Job where Job resists complaining, and then he starts to hear from his friends. And he gets a lot of talk and a lot of lecture about the things that, the reason why, and what if he'd done this right, it wouldn't have happened. And if he did this, then this would happen. And at the end of it, he complains and God finally responds and gives him a bit of a humbling talk. But the main question for today is, did all the talking console him? No. He let the people talk, but it did not help. When things are hard, I think we start to get our true feelings about the babbling. when you're in deep pain and someone's talking at you, generally you want them to go away. I think that's when we start being more honest. And we remember the wise know how to say less in those moments. 20 verse 3 says, avoiding a fight is a mark of honor, and only fools insist on quarreling. I mentioned that these were all written out of an honor-shame culture. Here's Van Leeuwen, a commentator's definition of that. An honor-shame culture is a culture in which persons are publicly affirmed and celebrated for the virtue and well-being they bring to the community, and they're conversely condemned for the havoc they wreak on the community. In our society, one of the highest values is expressing our authentic self, our personal impressiveness, and we're often praised for distinguishing ourselves from the community, which is interesting. So just different cultural tendency. So we often gauge our value and our ability to stand out from our critics, argue with our community, call out wrongdoing, and say, I have a unique view. I was writing this sitting in Cartel, and SZA was on in the background, and she was, the line was, you call me on my BS. And I was like, SZA's saying this right now. Like, she's basically, the cultural value is call out, right? That's how we gauge our honor. If we're up for it, if we've got good call-outs. Here, avoiding a fight is the mark of honor, and only the fool insists on quarreling. That doesn't mean that you're not willing to say hard things. It doesn't. But patience treats this more like a physician. Okay, so say I had a discolored finger, right? And I went in to see Celeste or Michaela or Justine in the hospital and said, why is my finger like green, you know? And they said, let's cut it off. Wow, yeah. Chop, no finger. Okay, wow, that's very fast. Okay, thanks. I would not appreciate that. I would like them to have some knowledge on the... I'd like them to know my medical history. I'd like them to know what happened leading up to this. And then to operate with an appropriate urgency depending on the condition that they have diagnosed, right? I'd like them to pay attention. The fight or the quarrel is to respond without calculation or understanding. The good critique, the good hard word, is one that comes from knowledge of what's going on, from a good evaluation, okay? 29:11, fools vent their anger, but the wise quietly hold it back. Again, it doesn't say they don't feel anger. It just says they don't vent their anger. They quietly hold it. They hold it. And that doesn't rule out that they wouldn't consult with somebody else about it or pray about it. But it means that they don't need to immediately blow it out. They hold it. They wait. They contemplate. Patience takes a feeling and reflects and waits and seeks the core issue before speaking. Again, this isn't repressing, because what happens when you just push anger down, you use a substance, you keep busy, you push it, anger or any other hard emotion. What happens, and we know this, is it will lead to a day when it will blow up. It will come out, and it will be big and painful. So to be patient isn't to repress, it's to know, name, and examine our feelings. That's what it means to hold it. So now I ask, is this just a competing ideology? Like, is this just a different way of, is this counterculture? Is this just one culture does it this way? Where do we get this? Is this, why do we say this is a good idea? Well, that gets us back to the premise of Proverbs and wisdom literature. It gets us back to the conversation we had with the kids. Patience is not an invention of God. It's not a rule he just made up for us because we're annoying. Patience is a description of God. Probably one of the key moments in the Bible is when God he's giving the laws to Moses on the mountain, on Mount Sinai, after they've been delivered out of Egypt, which is really important. The law comes after redemption. This is important theologically. It's how it works for us. You receive redemption from God, and then you respond to him and follow him. But Moses wants to see God. He wants evidence. He wants to know God is real. He wants to know what God's like. He wants an anchoring for the law. He doesn't want just law. He wants a God to know, to see. And God tells him that if he fully sees him, he won't survive, but he gives him a gift. He gives him a glimpse. Here's what it says in Exodus. The Lord came down in a cloud and stood there with him. The Lord called out his own name, Yahweh, which is the verb to be in Hebrew. Like, it's almost like him just saying existence, which is like deep. Yeah. The Lord passed in front of Moses, calling out, Yahweh the Lord, the God of compassion and mercy, I am slow to anger and filled with unfailing love and faithfulness. I lavish unfailing love to 1,000 generations. I forgive iniquity, rebellion, and sin, but I do not excuse the guilty. I lay the sins of the parents on the children and grandchildren. The entire family is affected, even children in the third and fourth generation. Moses threw himself to the ground in worship and said, O Lord, if it is true that I found favor with you, then please travel with us. This is a stubborn and rebellious people, but please forgive our iniquity and sins and claim us as your own possession. That's his response. God, when he self-declares to Moses, when he's giving the law, this is one of the most important moments in the Bible, in redemptive history. Part of the vision is that God is indeed angry, and justly so, with many things, with the state of the world, with people, with what people have done, with the impact that people have upon other people. And it's not that he won't act, but he's slow to anger. And he prioritizes redemption, forgiveness, and mercy without denying the evil in the world or in the hearts of humanity. He holds these two things together. That's the revelation of God. That's where we get that. That's why it's wisdom to do such things. Which leads into why we cultivate patience. And that's the number one reason. If you've come to believe in God, the question is, what is God like? That's question one. And how do I walk with and imitate and know this God? That's question number one. That's the task of worship. To worship is to do what Moses did, to come before God and say, I want to know you. I want to see you. That's the point. It's a way of worshiping God and following Jesus by saying your way is best. And I want to know you more by walking in it. So that's the big reason. That's reason number one. But there's a secondary reason that makes wisdom what it is. So wisdom, we noted last week, when Solomon is found out to be wise, the Queen of Sheba travels all the way to hear his wisdom, and she takes it back home, and Ethiopia claims that it shaped their culture. Okay, so we can read this because we, as people who are outside of Israel, have come near and said, it seems like the ways of this God and the stuff in the Bible is exhibiting wisdom. And how are we drawn to that? Because to some degree it works. There's some pragmatism to this. If you want to exhibit God to people, if you want to share who God is, exhibit wisdom. Live it. Try. Point to it. Speak of it. Looking at a few more Proverbs here. 16:32, better to be patient than powerful, better to have self-control than to conquer a city. Here, self-control is contrasted with the macho warrior way of being, which has always been countercultural to some degree. But the core of it the core that everybody needs to ask, everybody in the world needs to ask, is what's the goal of life? Everybody needs to ask that. Is it winning? Is it conquering? Is it money? Is it power? If that's the point, then conquer cities and fight everybody. Sure. But if that's not the purpose of life, if that's not what's most important in life, then something else must be prioritized. And we need to ask, that's a core faith question. And it's a good question to ask people who don't know what their faith is, so what's the point in your way of thinking? What's life for? And that could be a long journey of discovery, but it's a good question. Because what is ultimate is going to drive us. What is ultimate is what we will live for. And if you don't have a good answer to powerful people who destroy cities, then you can't really critique them. 25:28 says, a person without self-control is like a city with broken down walls. Now, the person is the city. This proverb exhibits how impatience can leave us vulnerable. You know, broken walls let everybody in, especially those you can't trust. And patience discerns who you can trust. There's a tension between vulnerability and boundaries, right? Patience is what you need to discern when to be vulnerable and when to have a boundary. If 25:28 is about becoming vulnerable to enemies, then 18:19 is the impact of impatience upon your friends. It says, an offended friend is harder to win back than a fortified city. Arguments separate friends like a gate locked with bars. Think about offending a friend, which happens, right? Enemies expect to be offended, right? If somebody hates you and you say, I hate you too, they're like, yeah, that's the deal. That's the deal we have. You know, I don't like you. You don't like me. But when you offend a friend, what's happening there is the betrayal of trust. It's one thing to look at a person and say, I don't know if I can trust you. That's a hard thing to discern. It takes time. It's another thing to trust someone deeply and then to experience them betraying your trust knowingly. That is very painful and difficult to recover from. You know, the modern proverb is, don't burn your bridges, right? And the thing about bridges is that they are things that take a lot of time to build that you depend on. And you need to think about that, right? So in like the war metaphor, you come across a bridge to get to the island. It's the only bridge. Well, if you burn that, you are going to have to spend a decade building it or you're stuck. That's why you don't burn a bridge. And so it is with friendships. Friendships take years to build and they can burn down far faster than they're built, like a bridge. Patience, being slow to anger, discerns how valuable something is before it burns it. And that's true for everybody. You don't have to be a Christian for that to be true. 25:15 says, patience can persuade a prince, and the literal here is a soft tongue can break bones. This is an irony, okay? An irony is that the softest tissue of the body can break the hardest. Feels fake. I mean, we know in real life, if I had a cow tongue and a cow bone, the tongue doesn't break the bone, right? We know that, right? It's just going to be weird and sloppy and floppy. What this proverb is saying is that, ironically, the softest tissue, the softest organ, has the most power. This is one I think we doubt the most. I think we think that if you need to persuade a prince, you need to be smart and assured and talk confident. And that if somebody's bones need to be broken, that we need to go in there kicking and screaming and yelling. But this is saying, if you want to persuade a powerful person, have patience. And if you want to put somebody in their place, talk soft. What? Famous book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. So Dale Carnegie studied how to really change people's minds and how to bring somebody into relationship with you when it's difficult to do, right? And he acknowledges that it feels like expression and argument are our power moves, but what he concludes in the book is that people change the most when they feel as if they've been heard well, when their viewpoint has been valued, and when you understand their point of view. That is when people change. This counterintuitive wisdom that the softest organ can break the hardest, of course, isn't true, you know, in war or something like that. But when it comes to changing a prince's mind, well, maybe it does work in war, huh? Depends on the point. To change the prince's mind and heart, the counterintuitive is true, that you need to understand, value, and hear. So what's the goal? The final why I'm going to glean from the New Testament, it's God-shaped and pragmatic. It's the practical, the way that God changes us with his patience and kindness. 1 Peter 3 to 15 is a unique teaching about God's anger and patience. And I'm going to read pieces of it here. Peter opens the part that comes before this with how people will mock God's people for their waiting, basically. He says, people will mock you. They'll say, where is this Jesus that was supposed to return? Where is this God that you say you believe in? He's doing nothing. He hasn't fixed anything. And then he writes this, to the Lord, a day is like 1,000 years. 1,000 years is like a day. The Lord isn't being slow about his promise, as some people think. No, he's being patient for your sake. He doesn't want anyone to be destroyed. He wants everyone to repent. He's saying for your sake, God's being patient because he wants your heart to change. He wants us to be heard and understood, to hear and understand. He wants us to change. But then he says, but the day of the Lord will come as unexpectedly as a thief, and the heavens will pass away with a terrible noise, and the very elements will disappear in fire, and the earth and everything in it will be found to deserve judgment. So it's not that God doesn't have anger at the brokenness. It's not that he doesn't care that the world is a mess. It's not that God won't act. Peter will go on to describe the purifying work of God, and to describe that God doesn't obliterate creation, but restores it, which is a beautiful thing. And then he says, so dear friends, while you are waiting, make every effort to be found living peaceful lives that are pure and blameless in God's sight. And remember, our Lord's patience gives people time to be saved. So it's the patience is for you and the patience is for others. And so why are you to live these peaceable lives, pure and blameless? Because you're God's agents of peace to people while God is being patient. Okay? If God's patience is what saves us and God's patience is meant to save others, then how much more should we who've experienced and stand because of a patient God offer that mercy and patience to other people? If we experience patience, we can offer patience. If we cannot offer patience, what does it say of our experience of patience? If we can't offer patience, perhaps our number one goal right now should not be to worry about anybody else, but to understand how patient God is with me and to learn about his grace. So how to cultivate it, final point. 22:24-25 said, "Don't befriend angry people or associate with hot-tempered people, or you will learn to be like them and endanger your soul." My first argumentative question with this, because I like to interrogate things, was, so are we impatient with impatient people? Is that right? Is that, that seems, so if you can't be their friend, like, are you impatient with that or what? And it, you know, it doesn't, it's a proverb. It's hard candy. You got to work it for a while, but God is patient with impatient people. Maybe the question we need to ask is, am I able to be patient with this person without becoming like them? Maybe that's a big question we need to ask. And choose friends who are malleable and willing to seek God and become patient together. But we can continue to linger on that one. Proverbs 29:20. There's more hope for a fool than for someone who speaks without thinking. This is another ironic proverb. There was more to it. I forgot to read. Where did it go? It was actually from 17. Even fools are thought wise when they keep silent. With their mouths shut, they seem intelligent. That's the, you know, the funny part. If you just sit in the corner and like gaze off and do this, you'll look real smart, even if you're not. But interestingly, the part of the irony is not just that you'll fake it till you make it. It's also this: if you want to appear more wise, do what wise people do. And in doing what wise people do, you will become wise. Does that, fake it till you make it's kind of close in this case. This is putting an emphasis on what ancient people knew and we forget. You don't become just by knowing, you become by doing. So when you see a wise person, don't just sit there and say, wow, I wish I was wise like them. Mimic them. And not only will you appear wise, and that might be fun, you'll become more like them when you do what they do. But the most powerful thing we can do is what we cannot do. And that lands us back in the fear of the Lord, the beginning of wisdom. When you know that God is to be feared, that you require his patience, that his slowness to anger is the reason that you and I can stand, when you know that you both require patience and receive and experience that patience from God, this will bring you the two things that you need, humility and ability to offer patience to others, to slow your emotions and respond in grace. And such an experience will have a powerful impact on others. But there's nothing you can do. You can't do this. You have to receive it. God is a patient God. If this is true, if God is a patient God, you can know his patience. And sometimes all that means is that you slow down and look at what's really going on. Like, think about what it's like to deal with you and me. If you have friends or a spouse, think about what it's like to be them. And then think about what it's like to be 10 times more righteous than them and still be patient with you. That's humbling. But when you see that, that sounds kind of scary, like think about how crummy I am. Well, it would be, except for the response of God is lavish mercy. Lavish mercy, abundant mercy. In the face of that, he gives abundant mercy. And when you're aware of that, when you're feeling that, it becomes actually second nature to be patient. So how we become patient is to receive and contemplate God's patience for us. The Lord passed in front of Moses, declaring, "Yahweh the Lord, the God of compassion and mercy, I am slow to anger and filled with unfailing love and faithfulness." We're going to move into our three rhythms of worship, which are confess, receive, and offer. I've queued up confession for you. We have a 2-minute silence here after a prayer. And let's think about what it's like to be patient with us. Let's just give that 2 minutes this evening as a community, silently. Then we receive. Here at Mission, there are many ways we receive the mercy of God and Jesus. There are many ways we receive his grace. One of the ways we symbolize that is by taking the Lord's Supper. Once Mike is up here and begins to play some songs, you'll see some people lining up here, and you're welcome to join that. If you see the compassion and mercy of Jesus, if you see his patience toward you, you're welcome to receive it. That's all it takes is to open hands and say, I need that. That's faith in a nutshell. I need that. We come empty-handed to Jesus. We come acknowledging his great patience and mercy to us, and he gives it to us. That's the table. On the night Jesus was betrayed, he broke bread and said, this is my body broken for you. Every time you eat of it, remember me. What are you saying? They, by the way, they didn't just eat bread on the Lord's Day. They ate it every day. That was a core meal they ate. Every time they ate bread, they would have this little light go off. It took a lot of mercy. Jesus had to break for me to be whole. Jesus gives me everything I need. I'm not able to provide for myself. They were remembering that over and over. So then what do you offer to a poor person who can't provide for themselves? What do you offer to somebody who needs a lot of mercy? Well, I need it. I can offer it, right? We receive. He took the cup and said, this is my blood shed for the forgiveness of many. Said, I tell you the truth, I won't drink of it again until I drink it in my Father's kingdom with you. This is pointing forward to that restored creation, but in it is this idea of the same thing that happened on the Passover, that God, it's not that he doesn't pay attention, it's not that he isn't angry, it's that he's extremely gracious and he atones for us. Jesus died to take the anger of God in our place so that his mercy could be lavished on us and we could be free. And when we experience that, it's meant to be a reminder that that's what people need. They need forgiveness. You can point to the forgiveness of Jesus. The best way to point to the forgiveness of Jesus is to offer the forgiveness from you. And people will feel it. Our final step is offer. We do that in two different ways. As you leave this table, you'll see the table back there with the lit up window. We have monetary giving, which is a cornerstone of offering in the scriptures. But at the same time, we have this window back there. What's that all about? Today, what I want to encourage you to name and write on that window, and don't worry if you write over people. The goal is at the end of the year, that is just a mosaic of letters we can't even read, that the light shines through, and we just think about the beauty of what God's doing in our community. So write all over it. Just name with a word or a phrase how you could offer patience this week. Just this week. So name something back there and think about how you could offer because of what Christ has done for us. I'm going to pray, and there will be 2 minutes of silence for you to spend time in confession. Let's pray. Father, we want what Moses wanted. We want to see a glimpse of you. And this evening, you're inviting us to look at your patience. So as we look at ourselves, I pray that our gaze would immediately begin to look to you and how full of compassion and how powerful and how loving and how kind you are to us. So lead us now as we pray.